Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast, Sunday the 26th of February. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
So the week that was, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. I mean, many people said that it would be over in a couple of weeks. I think Putin thought it would be over, but here we are 1 year on, showing no signs of letting up. Devastating impact with an estimated 188,000 Russian casualties. That's just the Russians. Probably can't quantify the Ukrainian casualties, including innocent bystanders, let alone the Ukrainian army casualties that are mounting up. 12 months since Putin launched this. It's a very hard not to do this, isn't it? The old special military operation with the old fingers, upending the lives of millions, and the fighting rages on. What are your thoughts on that? For me, it's got another year minimum.
I don't really know, is my answer. I don't know, and I don't think anybody really knows. Because the problem we've got is we're dealing with it's wrong to call him a madman, maybe, but he's obviously got an agenda that isn't necessarily Russian based. The Russian people, are they going to turn against him eventually? Are they going to be able to turn against him? Do they know the full truth? For sure, I don't think they do, but they're also not stupid group of people, so. It's hard to know, isn't it? It's hard to know. I mean, this whole Ukraine is a Nazi state and they want to... Yeah. I mean, it's wearing thin, and it must be wearing very thin with the Russian people as well, especially as, you know, sons, husbands, fathers are all being shipped off. And basically, as you said, 188,000 people died. I mean,
it's madness. I mean, mental. There's a divide, apparently, between the younger generation Russians, the 30-somethings, 20-somethings, and then the older, more mature, the pension age, who are obviously the diehard, staunch, we want the denazification of that they're following the Putin line. And then you've got the youngsters who've got brothers and sisters who were living in Ukraine, etc., because obviously they were very close, being a former Russian state. But there was one article I was listening. In fact, I sent it you, a video clip of an American guy who studied Putin for the last 23 years. And basically, he said that all the whole war is about in the last 8-9 years in Crimea is a distraction for him. So basically, war is a distraction because of the amount of money that he's embezzled from the country. They reckon him and his cronies have taken something like $1 trillion away from that country. And it's just a distraction. You know, people won't look at me. It's, you know what I mean? It's like a diversion tactic, which makes perfect sense. You know?
Yeah, look over here while I'm picking your pocket.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. What else has happened? I mean, let's not dwell too much on that because it is. I mean, the FTSE is flirting with 8,000 all the time. It's dipping below. It's going over.
In the States, there was more people thinking the US could still raise rates, rapidly and significantly still. So, the US dollar took another uptick. You know, at one point it was at 100 or just...
I think they've avoided recession there, which is good. And I think they're saying that because the US has avoided recession and they've seemed to have got their inflation under control to a certain extent, they can raise the rates a little bit more. But they're saying that the UK shouldn't go into recession based on the way we follow the US. So that it may be true. I don't know whether there's any truth in that. But
yeah. Well, the US dollar has become stronger again. So it's ticked up another 4 points now. It's on 104, which, is not really a good thing for the rest of the world. But it's showing that people are believing that interest rates are going to probably continue to go up because there's been more inflow into the dollar, if you like. But one of the things that was happening was that copper had ticked. I've got this pellet of copper. Do you remember seeing this in Cabway when we got the copper? So copper came above the $4 per pound to $4.20 this week. So it was a reasonably significant move. So that puts it significantly over 9,000 tons $9,000 a ton now. So yeah, that's happened. And yeah, I also this week, one of the things I did this week was go to the home school and talk to them about the chrome and the copper. We talk about the cobalt as well. So, and next week I will carry on with some more information about that, that we picked up in South Africa initially with Jubilee Metals. Yeah, Jubilee Metals is currently on sale, by the way, at under 10p. Because of the news of what did happen last year, but nobody seemed to think about the positives about what was going to happen this coming year.
There was the sad news of the passing of, obviously, John Motson. What a voice. I mean, was there ever a better one for football commentary, the tone? I mean, here, listen to this. This is him on Michael Owen, I think, putting them ahead against Brazil in the 2002 World Cup quarterfinal.
Heskey, Owen sprinting away to the left here against Lucio. Michael Owen for England, it's a great chance, and he scored! Michael Owen against Brazil in the World Cup in the 23rd minute. England are in front. Michael Owen and England sizzling in the heat of Shizuoka. And after this, the sausages will be sizzling back home, I should think.
It was the voice of my childhood and growing up and listening to Liverpool win nearly every game that they played in. So yeah, I have very fond memories of John Motson in terms of his commentary. He was never completely outspoken in the way he commentated. He was very
I remember him saying, oh, Balak, when Balak scored against it for Chelsea.
Yeah, yeah.
Balak, he always, and he, there was the one about the German player, as we know, it's, that starts with a K, ends with a TZ. You know, it's the C word, effectively. And he made some really good jokes around that. It's time for the hardworking to come off. And he was brilliant in the way that he added a bit of humour to his, you know, to his commentary.
But statistically and technically, he was a serious mind, wasn't he? He knew a lot.
Encyclopedic knowledge, wasn't he? And the other thing,
how things connected.
Exactly. And the other thing about him, a lot of people say this, is that, you know, we all felt like we knew him in some way. He was like that father. I actually met him once in Manchester when I was working up for the BBC, because obviously he did a lot of work up there. And I saw him in the hotel lobby and said, and he was just a lovely guy. You know, he would be approachable. He was talkable. He was a good guy. So very sorely missed. So the other thing that cropped up this week, and I was reading an interesting article, and basically the article was discussing the work of a doctor, Dr. Oliver Zolman. He's a young Cambridge medic who's trying to prove that aging can be quantified in all organs of the body, and that it can be reversed, or aging can be reversed. And he's been working, or he's fascinated with a client, a guy called Brian Johnson, who's he's an immensely rich software entrepreneur who funds a team of more than 30 medics and health workers led by this Solman guy to monitor the function of his body and all its organs. And his lifestyle is mad. You can look it up online. He wakes up at 5 a.m. He does like a 1 hour workout, and he's like, you know, strict calorie control, vegan diet, massive exercise regimes, constant blood tests, ultrasound scans, colonoscopies, and endless other interventions. And his idea is he wants to turn his body back from, I think he's about 42 43, and he wants to go back to sort of 21 22. And all signs so far are proving that he's got his skin is you know, he's getting younger. And it's just madness. And it basically, there's a lot of ethical and practical concerns regarding the work and his lifestyle. And it's obviously, it's very expensive. He's putting massive amount of money into this, you know, and it's obviously not going to be accessible to the masses. So it's interesting. But it kind of segues nicely onto our next guest, who's in this longevity space. Dr. Eric Lear, founder and CEO of Genflow Biosciences, a leading biotechnology company that is focused on developing innovative treatments for age-related diseases. Welcome back, Eric. How are you doing?
Very good. Nice to see you again, Kevin and Phil.
Very good as well, yeah. So for the listeners who may not have heard the first roast we did with you, do you want to just talk through what it is exactly that Genflow Biosciences does?
Yeah, Genflow is a longevity company. Means we want people to age better. So we develop a gene therapy that not only allow you to live longer, but if I give you 30 years of miserable life, it's not a gift. But what we want is to make the last year of your life very enjoyable. By not enjoyable, I mean without type 2 diabetes, without Alzheimer, without cancer, without stroke. So delay all those age-related disease, and also diminishing the decline in cognitive function, in mobility, in balance, in audition, that we generally associate with aging.
The whole purpose of this area of science is to make us live longer or just better. If you don't live longer for whatever reason, you're going to live better during that period of time.
The longer is the cherry on the pie. Okay. Again, if I give you 30 more years, but you spend these 30 more years going to chemotherapy, dialysis, having an Alzheimer, that's not a gift.
Quality of life.
Oh, so it's really delaying what we call aging. Aging is not a fatality. We understand that, we start to understand the biology of aging. We can act on it. It works really well on animal models. We're demonstrating that, like a lot of labs, organization, and some biotech companies. We all have the same results, some good results in animals. We're able to delay age-related disease, and we're able to delay the decline in function that's generally associated with age. So it's much more living better, longer.
Yes, and better being the first word, not longer. Exactly. Longer being the first word. So the reason why you're different than everybody else from the little research I've done, and don't for 1 minute think I've done lots of research, but I have done some, is this CERT6, which is basically something that is going to affect many factors of the aging process. Whereas many of the other bioscience companies are concentrating on maybe one thing or another thing or another thing, whereas this seems to be not affecting anybody from a point of view or a genetic point of view. So in other words, if you were to have this therapy and then subsequently have children, it's not going to pass on to the children. And tell us how this works then, or how you hope it works.
You're perfectly right, Kevin. CERT6, first, we are a gene therapy. That means we think there's a genetic component on aging, and we all, it's not hard science. We all experience people who age gracefully. They have nothing. They still run marathon past 80 and seem that's never sick. And you see people who are really destroyed by aging, and people were before in very good shape. And it's really unfair that some people have the good genetic material to protect them on aging, and some have not as good genetic material. If you take, also to convince you it's gene related, if you take a dog, whatever you do, if it has a very good quality of life, good education, good, it will live something like 10 years. In human, we have a different genome and we live 80, 90 years. If you're a mouse, it's 2 to 3 years. So it's defined by your genome. When you want to do a genetic intervention, you have to be ethical. That means you, as you mentioned, you don't want the things to be inserted in your genome and you keep it forever for your kids. Because if something goes wrong, you want the possibility to stop. CERT6 is quite interesting. It's part of the gene that does the DNA damage management. Our DNA is very fragile and breaks. When it breaks, we evolve. When I say we, every living organism has this problem with DNA and has to fix DNA damage. And therefore, we evolve many genes. CERT6 is one of them. Those genes that are repairing DNA are quite old, and therefore they are quite big, and they usually have multiple functions. CERT6 is one of these genes that are epigenetic regulators that control the repair of DNA, but it's a very small gene and it only codes for one protein. So we can really identify what it does. It has been proven to extend the lifespan, and it has been also demonstrated that in animal models, when you add some CERT6, you had life expectancy. So you had years to the life of a mouse, of a dog. So it has been demonstrated in human animals. What really made us choose sirtuin-6 was publication in 2012 by Vera Gorbunova in New York. And she correlated the quality of sirtuin-6 in the difference of lifespan of different rodents. Rodents are the same animals from the same family. On one hand, you have mouse. A mouse lives to 2 to 3 years. And on the other hand, of the rodent family, you have the beaver or the naked mole rat. They live 30 years. A 30 years difference between the two. And she demonstrated that the quality of their sirtuin-6 was correlated with the lifespan of those rodents. And what's extremely interesting, they demonstrated also in the paper that the difference in the sirtuin-6 of a mouse and the sirtuin-6 of a beaver were only 3 to 5 amino acids. So very small modification. Of course, that begs the question, could we have a better sirtuin-6 in human? So we sequenced a lot of centenarians and we discovered mutation, in fact, 2 different mutations that you can find only in centenarian, and that those mutations of sirtuin-6 three times more potent as a gene to repair DNA. So they repair better their DNA and therefore they live longer. The study of centenarian is extremely interesting. And that comes again to your question, longer or better? The things about centenarian is they usually don't die from a cancer, from diabetes, from a stroke. They go to bed at 110 and they die quite fully. And they never seen a dialysis machine. They never went to a chemotherapy. They not especially have a good quality of, you know, a good discipline of life. My friend Nir Barzilai, who is obsessed with centenarian, is professor at the College of Medicine, Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, like to interview centenarian. And he tell me this story that I found really representative of that. It's a good illustration. He was interviewing a woman, 106, and during all the interviews, she was smoking. But chain smoking, just one cigarette after the other. He interrupted her and he said, sorry, lady, but I'm a medical doctor. You know, I need to ask you the question. He said, did ever a doctor told you to stop smoking? And said, oh, yes, yes. 3 of them, they all died.
She outlived them all.
The point of the story is, when you have good DNA, good genes, not only you live longer, but you live from disease-free. And those centenarian, again, they don't spend the last 10 years of their life going to dialysis, going to chemotherapy. You know, that's not what we want to achieve. It's really to allow people to benefit from a high quality of life until the last day.
Yeah, I'm getting this analogy in my head that actually some of us are running on that really cheap oil that actually only lasts a little while. But some of us have super duper synthetic Castrol GTX, whatever it's called, oil inside us. And effectively, exactly. We all need to have the Castrol GTX if we're going to live a bit longer. And so the question I pose then as in my view, someone who probably doesn't have the genes that's going to live to 110 years old, is what are you going to do to allow people to have that SIRT6?
What we do is to provide extra copies of sirtuin-6, because with time, what we call aging is in fact this genetic machinery that's supposed to repair DNA. With age, the DNA damage accumulate, and those genes are overwhelmed. So they need some help. They need a little boost, a little turbo. And we bring this turbo as a sirtuin-6, but as we are there, rather than giving you the regular sirtuin-6, we give you the help of a super sirtuin-6 that you find only in centenarian that has 3 times the ability to repair the DNA damage. So that's what we do. We've done so far, we're in preclinical, so we didn't test in human. We did the first part, the in vitro, so mostly looking at What happens when we administer this sirtuin 6 variant to human cells, isolated cells in culture, and we got tremendous results. The next step, and that's what we are now embarking now, is to demonstrate that in a living organism, and we take mice because mice are the typical model for that, we have the same benefits. So we are engaging now in three different sites, one in the US, one in the UK with Liverpool University, and one in Belgium with CER, in three different mouse study. That will be a total of 800 mice. That will be 350 in the US, 350 mice in Liverpool in the UK, and we'll have the rest to add up to 800 mice in Belgium.
So nobody from animal rights can complain because you're trying to make these animals live longer and better.
Yes. In fact, it's we are to be allowed to start in mice. You need to have a strong rationale. And so that's why we started in the cells and in the in vitro assays in the cells of human cells. We had some very convincing data that allow us to pass all the ethical committees. So we went through two ethical committees, not yet in Liverpool. They should meet and we start the experiment as soon as we get the go-ahead from the ethical committee. But we got the go-ahead from the ethical committee in New York and the one in Brussels.
So how far away are you from moving into human trials from that? Should all the results be satisfactory from the mice?
In to answer that with perfect precision, I will need to have the result from our meeting with the European Agency. That will happen in June. So before you get an IND or a clinical trial authorization from the agency, but before this meeting, you have another one and they look at the data you have. And by June, we'll have this meeting. We collected enough data. It will present also the data from the mouse. So from those 350 mice in New York, 350 in Liverpool, and so total of 800 mice coming. And after that, we'll have to do some called toxicity studies. So we'll give very high dose of the sirtuin 6 until you get toxicity. We will not find toxicity because it's a gene that it's we're bringing something that already exists. It's not like we're bringing a penicillin, a different chemical entity. So that's a formality, but it's an expensive and long formality because it's chronic tox and you have to do it. It's part of the stuff. Sure. And as soon as we have all that, we start in human.
Yeah.
We will start in two different indications. You remember that we had some very promising data in liver. This has been published recently. We had our paper accepted in Geroscience, a very good peer-reviewed journal, where we explored the effect on lipids of our sirtuin 6 in the liver. So we will conduct clinical trial in NASH. NASH is this, it's called for non-alcoholic steatosis. That means it's fatty liver. Fatty liver doesn't seem terrible, but in fact, it's a growing disease that will emerge from our lifestyle. We drink too much fat, we drink too much sugar. Mostly the sodas are terrible, and that leads to an accumulation of fat in the liver. Even if it's sugar, it transforms in fat, and you have a fatty liver. The next step, and that's the case for almost half American, have a fatty liver right now.
Wow.
All age. A significant portion, something of 50% of those people, even a little bit more, will evolve to some stage of fibrosis. Your liver becomes fibrotic. It's inflammatory, it's fatty, inflammatory, fibrosis, and then you evolve to cirrhosis. That means you need to find a new liver, and ultimately it will evolve to hepatoma. So those, that means that something like, if things are as they stay without any treatment, 10% of the population in the next 20 years will require liver transplantation. Will be a major, major issue. That's why everybody is looking for a cure for NASH, this non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. It's a very attractive market, very interesting, very large opportunity. What's really nice for us is, as opposed to the other treatment that our people try to develop, we don't attack only fibrosis. We don't attack the fat. We don't even attract the cancer. We have action on everything. At every step of the evolution, we have an action, a specific action on everything. So we reduce the fat, we reduce the fibrosis, that's the paper we presented. We also reduce the cancer risk. So we are a cancer suppressor in liver. So we're very, very excited by that. It could be a major opportunity for us to deliver. It's also very interesting to choose liver because among all the organs, liver is the only one with the skin that we can regrow. If you're a salamander, I cut your arm, the salamander regrow an arm. We cannot do that. But if I cut part of your liver will regrow. So what's very interesting here is we can take an old liver, fibrosis, pre-cancer, and rejuvenate this liver to young, super healthy, functional liver. And we are very excited by this opportunity.
Sounds very good. Obviously, since you were last on, you also received some excellent news about the research program in collaboration with IVEX, in which I believe you were awarded a non-dilutive grant worth circa €250,000. Do you want to just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. Here we talk more business, and the business part is always important. Eh? It's all driven by money. And this is very cheap money. It's grant. It's grant that totally non-diluting. We don't have to reimburse. It's just cash advance. We got cash advance from the Wallonia region that covers 70% of the research we conduct everywhere in the world. And they allowed us to have now, you know, it cover also post-Brexit. They were first limited to Europe, but it covers now research we conduct in the UK. So for example, our 350 mice study that we'll conduct in Liverpool will be covered by this grant. This grant has been renewed. It was for 2 years, and we got the news a month ago that they will continue the same deal for the next 2 years. So that's a significant portion. In addition, we grab a little bit grants up there, here and there. And for a specific project on AAV, we had the project 100% financed by the Estonian government. So it was a €250,000 grant. So it's a gift of 250. We are continuing to pursue a lot of grants, non-diluting grants. It's part of our strategy to get as much non-diluting financing in the company. But we're not only focusing on grants. We want also to, we are a listed company. Our share price is, you know, like most biotech companies, early stage, suffered from the crisis.
Very good. So the last time we spoke, you were basically saying you had a clear runway. It was going to take maybe a couple of years to put the company into a situation where many things were going to come to fruition. We've got the liver stuff, we've got the better life and longer life to come. So do you still sort of stand by that, that we're talking about a couple of years? And from a financial perspective, you had a lot of cash back then, and you've also received cash since then, and also had grants. So are we still very viable in terms of cash moving forward? Can you see that you will have to try and raise money from the market or not? That was three questions.
You broke up a little bit, but you raised an excellent point. Sorry, I should have talked about that also. One of the appeal of the company is the fact that we have a long runway. So maybe the times are not good for early stage biotech, but we raised the money and we have something like a 2 and now 3 months runway. So without having to go to the market to raise money in poor terms, we have the ability to go through the storm, continue our scientific progress, not having to do any kind of shortcut or anything. We just focus on delivering what we promised, and we are on track. We have the good results so far, scientifically. So we are in a quite good position with this cash runway that allow us, again, to be very confident for the future.
And just remind me and remind people, what type of patents or protection have you got over the research that you've done on this SRIT6?
Yes, patents are key in our business. We have two types of patents. One is the composition of the Sirtuin 6 variant. We got the exclusive license worldwide from Columbia University, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and University of Rochester. That's a very important part of our patent, and we got recently some positive action from the patent office, so we are quite happy with that. It's progressing. We should have the patent issued, and we should go to in USPTO, and then we should move to national. So next step is PCT approbation, and then national. So that's going well. The second patent family is on the method of delivery, and we're working hard to expand that patent. So far the patent covered the AAV, but we're developing a way to blind the AAV to the immune system. And that's quite attractive because it allows you to repeat the AAV infusion without losing any efficacy. Because this AAV infusion will not trigger a response from the immune system, so there won't be any neutralizing antibody that will may compromise the efficacy after multiple infusions. So that's also an opportunity to grow the second family of patent on the delivery. So AAV, exo-AAV, what will end up with an IP position that's quite comfortable, where we have a long life. So when the patent will be issued, we'll have 20 years of protection, and we'll have also a very diversified patent portfolio. You know, it's key not to have all your eggs in the same basket when you have a company. If everything is covered by one patent, if someone for any kind of reason challenge your patent and say you infringed a patent, you put the entire company in danger, because then you have to defense, and you know, and it's this lawsuit can last forever, and it's always some kind of a sword over your head. That's threat.
The sword of Damocles over your head.
The sword of Damocles, yes, the famous Damocles, yes. But Damocles will not be over our head, because we will diversify our pipeline. So if someone say we infringe a patent, which could always happen, you never know. And then we have two other patents, so the company is not in jeopardy.
So I think I'm going to wrap it up with some questions about you, like Dr. Eric, okay? What is driving you to do this?
It's a combination of factors. One, being CEO of a biotech, public biotech, is a lot of work, and you need to be passionate. When you're passionate, you can work super hard, and you know, you're never tired, you have all the energy, but you need to be passionate. And longevity is one of my passions. So it's an area that's fascinating for me. In medicine, you have different therapeutic areas. You can go for cardiology, you can go for infectious disease, you can go. At one point in my career, for example, infectious disease, when I was resident, I remember I was saying I was being trained as a surgeon. And I discussed with one of my professors, and I said, you know, I don't know if I will be a surgeon. I like infectious disease also. And the guy laughed at me and said, infectious disease, are you crazy or what? This has no future. We have antibiotics. There won't be any infectious disease. It was before HIV.
I think it was
SARS-CoV-2. Okay. It was before multi-resistance TB. But hematology, for example, was the most boring specialty you had. And then there was a tipping point where you had GCSF and a lot of new way to treat leukemia. And then it became one of the most fascinating therapeutic area. Longevity, we didn't know a lot about aging, and no one was really looking at it. Right now, everybody is looking at it. The high quality scientists are moving, and we are understanding the biology of aging at fantastic speed. It's exponential speed. The more we discover, the more there's to discover, but we have now a better and better grasp on aging and the process that drives aging. It's a luck to be able to be part of this revolution. So that's what drives the passion I have for longevity. Second factor, it's personal factors. I have family members who age fantastically. They're 90, they still play tennis, they don't have any problems, they're still active in life. They are political activists, and they are 96, 92. And I have other members who are even younger than that, but they are ridden in bed with disease, and they were brilliant people. And to see those people having something miserable when they had, were so bright people, I think there's something to be done here. And that drives me also.
Yeah, good. I mean, I think we all need a personal aspect in some way, shape, or form in what we do. I think that gives us the passion. It gives us the drive, if you like, to actually do something. So if I gave you a crystal ball, and as you want everybody's life to be longer, 5 years from now, where would you see Genflow Biosciences?
In 5 years, there will be a lot of change. Within 5 years, I can tell you that we'll see some regulatory agencies like the MHRA, the FDA, the European Medicine Agency will consider aging as a risk factor like high blood pressure, like high cholesterol. It's a clear scientific fact that aging is a risk factor. You can see that you don't get type 2 diabetes when you're young, you don't get a stroke when you're young, you don't get cancer when you're young, except a few leukemia and glioblastoma. You don't get neurodegenerative disease when you're young also. So all those are linked with age. We've seen that age had a very bad influence on the immune system with the COVID. People who were dying were mostly old people. Their response to the vaccine is not as good. So aging is definitely a risk factor, and it can be managed. We can delay this process. So that will be regulated by agencies. Could be MHRA first, FDA first, maybe the European agency. But once one agency will consider aging as a disease or a risk factor, doesn't matter, you will see a major entry of pharma company. Pharma is not involved in longevity right now because it's since it's not their business. They want an entry barrier. They want the regulation from the FDA, from the European Agency, from the MHRA. Once that happens, they will acquire companies like mine. There's a few longevity biotech companies definitely establishing Genflow as one of the top 10 biotech companies. We are the most undervalued because we're not in the US. We expect to correct that short term with the trading in the US, but being European will be still undervalued. So I see Genflow as the target of a major acquisition by a pharma company.
You are actually a big threat to the pharma companies, no? Because ultimately...
Not at all.
You're going to make people effectively healthy and not require these medicines that the pharma companies put out.
Not at all. In fact, pharma is quite interested, and they start to send scouts. We already signed a couple of CDAs. We already talk with people from pharma industry. For them, that's the ultimate market. All they want to have is to have an entry barrier. The structure of the beauty of pharma is that's a very high entry barrier. Any kind of business where there's no entry barriers, if you're successful, there are 1,000 new guys that, okay, I can do the same and I can, okay. Pharma, once you're there, it's very difficult for newcomers to come because of this regulation. So their business is to be protected by a major entry barrier, and that's regulation. Once we have that, the best market ever, because for now, their market is lung cancer, it's Parkinson's, but not everybody will develop a lung cancer. Not everybody will develop Parkinson's, but everybody will age. That's the ultimate market, that's the largest potential market. And that's exactly the sweet spot. They will market. One thing you have to understand is there won't be one winner among the biotech companies developing the longevity therapies. It's like cancer. You don't think that cancer will come from one company. You have multiple companies bringing solution for cancers. Same thing with longevity. Aging is as complex, even maybe even more complex than cancer. So we partially understand cancer. We partially understand aging. We can act on cancer. We cannot fix all the cancer. We cannot fix now all the aging issues, but we can influence aging. That means because aging is multifactorial, driven by multiple factors, there will be several biotech that will come. It will not come, there won't be one silver bullet. There will be some interesting companies coming and could be 5, 10, you know, but a little bit like cancer. You don't say, oh, there's only one good company for cancer. It's not GSK, it's not BMS, it's not Novartis, it's not Merck. It's
all of them.
Companies are in cancer. Same thing with longevity, that will happen.
Okay, so is that going to mean that your goal as CEO of Genflow Bioscience is that 5 years from now, this is a $1 billion company?
Yes, definitely. Look, crazy ideas are always the best. And longevity may seem a crazy idea, acting on aging. But if you look at cancer, we're talking about cancer. The idea of what we call now IO, it's even an acronym, immuno-oncology, using the immune system to fight cancer. For 10 years, it was considered as a crazy idea. And then came the checkpoint inhibitors, came the CAR T cells, and we discovered that, wow, we can use the power of the immune system to fight cancer, and it has a much better safety profile than the chemotherapy or the radiation therapy that we used to use to treat cancer. When there was some proof of concept, when it was regulated, and that's what we have in longevity, regulation and proof of concept coming, you see a massive wave of pharma. Pharma was totally absent of immuno-oncology. Now, every pharmaceutical company, Novartis, Pfizer, they have immuno-oncology drugs. But when they reached a tipping point of proving that it was not only a crazy idea, but it was a very effective idea, you saw this acquisition of company like Juno, preclinical, Kite, preclinical, billions of dollars. So it's a very good benchmark. And again, if you compare aging and cancer, not everybody will develop cancer. Everybody will develop aging.
So from 5.7 million market cap with a few million pounds in, or a few million euros or whatever way you want to put it in cash, you're predicting a $1 billion company over the next 5 years. And that's a crazy idea, but we wish you good luck. I hope it works. And not only that, if it does work, 5 years from now, I'm coming to Belgium and you're going to treat me.
If the company is sold to an American company or UK company, you can do it from the UK.
No, I'm in Cairo. I'll have to come to you.
Very good. Well, on that note, we'll wrap things up. I think we've talked long enough, and with the passion that you show, Eric, I'm sure you could talk for another few hours, but... you know,
definitely. Stop me, please.
Stop me. So Dr. Eric Lear, the founder and CEO of Genflow Biosciences, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Eric.
Always good. Always one of those stocks, isn't it? Or that technology that wows you, doesn't it? If this you know, get it through to trials into human, and it's got the efficacy, then it's a game changer, isn't it?
Absolutely. It could blow your mind, this one. You know, from the change in humanity, never mind the share price. But for it to be so lowly valued at the minute seems a bit, you know, underwhelming, if you like. They have cash runway of a couple of years. So they have cash of a couple of million or more euros. They've got 70% of everything being paid for by the European Union. And they've got people sniffing around them, as he said. You know, they know that this is, you know, gonna work, if you like, I think. So yeah,
very good.
Very, very interesting.
So there's been a few highlights this week. We'll go through them. I'll start off. There was one that company called Star Phoenix. I think they're basically the top performer. They're up around 450%. They trading started in their shares. It was restored this week, a day after they released full-year results for the year ended 30th of June 2022. Loss before tax reduced to $1.2 million in the period, down from $1.9 million. The company has oil and gas services operations in Indonesia and Trinidad. So quite what moved that one. Obviously, the reduction in the loss before tax, but the market works in strange ways at times, doesn't it?
Certainly does. It's bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. 400 and something percent, you said?
Yeah, 400%. So they're around 2.2p, market cap of 3.2 million. I saw them actually start trading and again, and they just ticked up on every trade. So, yeah, quite, you know, whether they were oversold before, I don't know. I don't know a massive amount about them, but it was just, you know, you see these ones on SharePad and it moves 400%. I look at them at the end of the week and think, wow, what a week they've had.
Hands up if you want one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Don't we all?
Yeah, I mean, would it change somebody's portfolio if you had only held in six or seven stocks and you had one that did 400%? What would that actually do to the portfolio? You'd probably be up 60-70% on your total portfolio. So yeah. Oh, please, even if it's not over a week, let it happen over a few months is fine.
What else have you got? What's been on your radar this week?
Well, we had a completely new gold find, didn't we, in Conroy in Ireland, moving up from Clay Lake, where that huge gold nugget was found, which is in the Ulster Museum. They basically found the same type of gold because they were puzzled why that nugget was a quartz and not in the rock, if you like. It was actually quartz gold. So, that's... We keep saying it with Conroy, it's a game changer. But the share price did go up and is reacting. It's around the 20p mark now, which from it being around the 13p mark at its low is a good move. But it's so ridiculously undervalued for what it's got now. It beggars belief, it really does. So that was one. Another one which in my view is just waiting to like literally explode is the wrong phrase, because if it explodes then it would be very bad for this company, but it would be Teck Minerals and the lithium ion battery. They got the next level of before they get their license, if you like, so they have to do a few things and then put it back. I think it's called stage five. We're going to interview those guys next week, so look out for that one. Stage five, then they will have the licenses. So yeah, that's going to be an interesting one. And again, that's at a, you know, the share price is at such a point that I think if they sold all their assets in terms of the mining stock, they'd have more cash than the current market capitalization. That's my view on it. Anyway, I think it's significantly undervalued. But we've had this conversation with many companies, haven't we? That asset values are actually significantly higher than the share prices. So why do you think that's happening? You know, you can understand. I mean, even in some like funds, you get the NAV of the fund is higher than the share price. You know, even in special purpose vehicles and unit trusts and those type of things, it happens. But to have something that is like literally 70 or 80% or more lower than the net asset value, just, I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
No.
It doesn't. So there's got to be an uplift or a rewrite at some point in many of these stocks. I'm not talking necessarily about Teck Minerals, but Teck Minerals is one of them. Other than that, I haven't got a lot to talk about this week. I mean, I think there's a few things starting to happen with Chill Brands. It looks like the vapes have arrived in the US, so there's going to start to be a rollout of that. They've started to sneak a few things on Twitter. I've had a couple of conversations with Callum this week. We're planning to have a webinar with them. I think it's going to be the beginning of April, so that's like 4 or 5 weeks away.
Yeah.
We're also planning on having a webinar with Ben's Creek at the end of March. I had a conversation with Adam this week as well. All things seem to be on track there, and yet the share price isn't doing anything at all. So yeah,
Yeah,
that's one of
the shakers this week was Cineworld. The shares are down, were down 29% and worth less than 3 pence on the Friday. And it said that basically its shareholders may see the value of their equity wiped out as it looks to exit from Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection after it failed to find a buyer for the whole of the world's second biggest cinema chain. It said it had received initial proposals from a number of counterparties, but none offered an all-cash bid for the entire company, sadly. So in light of the level of existing debt is expected to be released under any reorganization plan, the company does not believe that there will be sufficient creditor support for a plan that contemplates any recovery for equity interest, it said in a statement. So sad news there all round. I mean, that one looked like it was bouncing back, obviously being hit massively during the pandemic. That's another casualty of the pandemic, isn't it, that one?
Absolutely.
So the other ones that were on the radar this week was Tech Capital. They had a good announcement. They actually had an oversubscribed placing, 2.25 million, to provide growth capital to their portfolio companies. Microsoft, and I've talked about that before, will receive £600,000 to build inventories, and Guidant will be allocated £1 million. That's their investments. And the remainder will be used for working capital. Microsoft's preparing for an AIM IPO, having appointed a Nomad in December. So that one looks exciting as it comes to market. Harland and Wolff, another one that we've mentioned in the past, they signed 6 small routine repair and fabrication contracts worth £10 million. The works will be carried out across their Belfast, Appledore and Arnish shipyards. And in addition...
Yeah, I saw that. There was planning permission applied for in Belfast, wasn't it, to extend...
extension of their fabrication halls as part of their recapitalization. So for the 1.6 billion FSS program. So that one looks massively undervalued at market cap circa 30 million with all these contracts coming in. And certainly an exciting one.
If they can do the business profitably, isn't it? You know, it's a big
old company, isn't it? When you look at
it, it's a big ask, isn't it? This is the problem. It's like big things and big prices and, you know, lots of labor, lots of people, lots of equipment, lots of everything, literally. So it's adding all that up and will it come good? I think it probably will. I really hope it will for the sake of industry in those areas. It will be fantastic. And obviously the shareholders will benefit as well. One of the things that has started to intrigue me, and I read an article about it this week, was, you know, what is the next big thing? You know, it's like we've talked about copper and its requirement. We've talked about lithium, and everybody's talked about lithium, and lithium is like the thing, if you like. But the one thing that this article was focusing on was graphite, okay, and the fact that graphite is going to have its day, and it was talking about different shares that are in the UK market that has graphite, and it was talking about Blenco Resources, it was talking about Tirupati, I forget the name of all the others, but you can also mention Sovereign Metals in there because of their graphite as well as their rutile, and that there is such a lack of this stuff. And even if there is an amount, China controls the whole game. So therefore, you know, these companies almost have to do well because they have the graphite, and it should start to do well. And moving on from that, the article then moved on to this whole rare earth thing as well, that, you know, we need these rare earths for the magnets and the different things that are required for the batteries. And again, you got a couple of companies there, I think, on the UK stock market. You've got Macango, is it? And you've also got, Macango is very interesting because they're starting to recycle the stuff as well. So that was an interesting play, not only just have the assets and possibly mine them, but also to recycle them. And then you've got... E-Star Resources, okay, who came out with some information about their rare earths recently, and that, you know, they're going to start to do the leaching tests, and the assays have been sent off to find out, you know, are they there? And it's a very simple process, I think, because they're literally digging it up, leaching it, and they're going to come away with the rare earths, which are worth over $50,000 a ton. Now, that's in a process state, so maybe the miners aren't going to get that much. But when you're talking about a significant tonnage, then even $10,000 a ton, you know, it's the same sort of price as copper, but you're actually digging it up and getting huge percentages to get that. These are maybe the next things that are going to happen. You know, we've gone through this process where we've got copper and nickel as well. You can add nickel in there as well, can't you? Copper, nickel, lithium. Graphite could well be the next one, and also rare earths, because they're needed to build this battery. And if we don't have this battery, what are we going to do? And then I think the next one after that, sorry for going on for so long, but the next one after that then is vanadium, which is the storage battery element that is required. So I think we're in this process. Maybe they'll all come similar times, but I think we're moving down this road. And where you are on this road, I don't know, but it's good to think about it from an investing point of view. Where should you be? Where should you position? Should you be in them all? Should you just be in the ones that are doing well at the minute? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think it applies to most commodities really that have been that are in demand, with whether they be in the EV space or in just general the infrastructure place, you know, copper and even silver to a greater extent. So, you know, they're just there's no value really added to it. And I think it's not until these large miners, or even not just the miners themselves, but the manufacturers like the Teslas of this world, the Neos, who need a supply chain and a reliable source of these metals start to take note and actually acquire, whether it be the mining companies or the junior mining companies, or start to go to the big miners and say, you need to get us a supply chain. So they're going to start to look at the junior miners who've got these assets. So absolutely, it's exciting. There was one a big company, you might have heard of them, Rolls-Royce.
Yeah, I think I've heard of Rolls-Royce. Yeah,
Rolls-Royce. Well, they had an RNS this week and they actually moved their stock 25%. They've improved orders, revenue, profit and cash flow in 2022. Driven by strong new order wins in the civil aerospace and defense and a record order book in the power systems. Remember, we talked about this, the moving out into this small nuclear reactor, so where they can install them in you know, in a part of a town, size of a football pitch, and they can then just power the town on these small nuclear reactors. So there's a lot of investment going into this next generation. They've also implemented a transformation program to achieve further performance improvements from 2023, with underlying operating profit guidance of 0.8 to 1 billion and free cash flow of 0.6 to 0.8 billion in 2023, and a strategic review to identify investment priorities with medium-term financial targets to be set in the second half of 2023. And the new CEO, Tufan Erginbilgic, emphasize the importance of creating a high-performing, growing and competitive business. So I quite like that they're branching out from the aerospace and defense industry into this new power system. That's exciting for me. And obviously a lot of shareholders on the market saw it and moved them up 25%. So good week for Rolls-Royce.
Yeah, they don't build the cars anymore though, do they?
Well, not them. It's they're owned. Are they owned by, is it BMW or someone like that? Who owns Rolls Royce? Yeah. Is it Tata Holding?
It's BMW. You're buying an expensive BMW. Exactly. So they're going to make them all rear-wheel drive? What? Don't get Phil started on cars.
Exactly. So no, that is, you're absolutely right. I don't think there's any or many manufacturing or British companies left. I mean, Lotus was one of the last ones. They're now owned by your friends, the Chinese.
Geely.
So Geely owns Lotus now. I mean, they've spent millions and millions putting into their factory in Norfolk, in Hethel, to make the new Lotus Emira. So fair play to them, because they're funding the next generation. And they're starting with their new electric Lotus EV. SUV. So, but you're absolutely right. But most of
Geely owned Volvo as well, because I bought one of the Chinese cars, and basically it was I can't say it was a copy of the Volvo, but basically all the Volvo engineers basically built it.
Well, that's what the Chinese do, isn't it? They basically take a BMW X5 or something and reverse engineer it, even have similar badges, and they call it the X5D or something, or what, you know what I mean? They just, it's bizarre. It's
no,
bizarre.
We have a make here called, it's called Brilliance.
Yeah.
And they have an X5.
Yeah.
And an X2.
Yeah.
And an X3.
So they don't even try and change the name.
No, and it looks like an X5 as well. So it's not like there's no copyright infringement going on here. It's like, here is an X5, I guess, but it's not BMW.
I guess that's the sheer brilliance of it.
Well, they're supposedly pretty cracked.
but I think it just emphasizes, doesn't it, that no small company these days is going to remain on the, you know, they need the backing of a larger manufacturer behind them. You know, the BMWs of this world, Jaguar was another example, wasn't it? Owned by Tata now, the Indian company, the big steelmaker. Mm. So, yeah, I think Lister is the only one that remains British-owned now, which is an interesting fact. So, yeah.
But anyway. it also goes along the fact that what we were talking about, that all of these bigger conglomerates want to secure their ability to get things, you know, and they're going to need, for this electrical vehicle revolution, if you like, they're going to need all of those things we just talked about, whether it's nickel, copper, lithium, graphite, rare earths. You know, they're going to need them. So they're going to have some sort of deals with the miners.
Sure.
Or they're going to buy the miners. Yeah. You know, I mean, I can see it happening. I can see it happening.
Well, it's already happening. I mean, Fortescue own Williams Advanced Engineering. They've actually made an investment and have actually got a racing team for they design a lot of the vehicles that go into the, you know, the Formula E series, which is an electric version of Formula One. Fortescue actually own Williams Advanced Engineering. So they're making investments right away. You know, it's happening as we speak.
Yeah, the bigger getting bigger and the smaller just getting eaten up. But if we're in the small cap market, that's got to be actually a good thing for the next period of time. So let's see what happens.
Good.
I'm still very confident that this year is going to come good. How long it's going to be, I'm not sure. But
good.
Yeah.
On that note, I think we'll say have a great rest of the weekend and catch up with you next week.
Yep. Enjoy.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.